This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. If this week's news gave you a bit of whiplash, you're not alone.
They've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them fight their own wars. The people of South Carolina want to see those troops come home. And I won an election based on that. And that's the way it is, whether it's good or bad. That's the way it is.
Northern Syria is where we'll start today in the Friday News Roundup. And joining us to help make sense of this week's international stories is Indira Lakshmanan, executive editor at the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Indira, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you.
Peter Bergen, national security analyst for CNN, vice president and director of the International Security Program at New America, and the author of The United States of Jihad. Peter, welcome. And Courtney Cuby, national security and military reporter for NBC News. Hey, Courtney.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It has been a week. We know there's a lot to talk about, and we know that this week's news has been a little bit entangled. There's a lot of stories that kind of wrap over one another and connect. So if you're at all fuzzy about what's happened this week or the way one story may connect to another, now's a good time to email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Let's begin with a shift in American foreign policy this week. President Trump's unilateral withdrawal of U.S. troops from northern Syria unraveled a fragile peace on the border between Turkey and Syria. They share a north-south border, Turkey at the north and Syria at the south. That left the Kurds, our allies in the fight against ISIS, to fend for themselves. They struck a deal with Syria. Turkey was involved. Courtney Cuby, can you just give us the basics of what the deal was that emerged this week?
So it was a 13-point plan, but like many of these, it lacked some specificity. So now it's just in the, 18 hours since it was agreed to and announced, there's already signs that of confusion on the ground. So the basic tenets, 120-hour ceasefire, that the Turks will not continue to push forward. And during that time, the U.S. will help the Syrian Democratic Forces / YPG, essentially the Syrian Kurds, move out of what had been an established safe zone. So where and then once that happens, assuming all the YPG and their families have all moved out of that area, the Turks have agreed to a permanent ceasefire. Okay, so where the problems set in is exactly what the safe zone is. So initially, there was what the U.S. military was calling a security mechanism, which was an area along the border with Syria and Turkey that went about 30 kilometers into the country, but it only extended, it's sort of up in the air how many kilometers it went, but it only extended sort of the central part of the border. It didn't go from coast to or from side to side, the full border of between Syria and Turkey. Well, it seems that now they've, and despite the fact that Erdogan wanted that whole border region, this agreement now gives them that entire border region. Well, the SDF are saying, well, it was our understanding that it was just the security mechanism, which is literally a fraction of that. It's about 25 to 30 kilometers along it rather than 440.
So the Kurds think it was just this narrow strip, or say it should be this strip. The Turkish government, their understanding is they've got that whole border, that north-south border.
And that's really what Vice President Pence and Secretary Pompeo announced in Ankara as well. It's they acknowledge that as well. So that's the first problem. The second problem is, Turkey, they're not calling it a ceasefire. They're calling it a pause. They are not necessarily agreeing to the idea that there will be a continuing ceasefire after these 5 days of a ceasefire. And then, to top it all off, within hours of this announcement, there's already fighting going on. There's reports of mortars and even some artillery shells along the border. So, the situation is still as tenuous and confusing as it really was 24 hours ago.
Yeah, Peter, not only has the ceasefire seemed to not have held at all within the first few hours of the 120 hours, but within hours of this announcement, it was clear that the U.S. statement on what this deal was and the Turkish statement on what this deal was were quite different. Turkey's foreign minister wouldn't even call it a ceasefire.
Yeah, he called it a pause. I mean, the interesting thing about the ceasefire is the principal combatants on one side weren't actually part of the ceasefire. I mean, so the United States was negotiating on behalf of the Kurds, and the Kurds themselves weren't really consulted. So, it's a very strange. Does anybody actually know what our Syria policy is, including the president? We've changed it several times already. In December of 2018, we were going to go to zero on the American troops. Then Trump was persuaded that was a bad idea because it handed the country to variously Russia, Iran, ISIS, and Assad. And then he changed his mind again, and with really the same outcome, really, that you know, who benefits? Russia, Assad, ISIS, and Iran.
By the way, we mentioned that Turkey's foreign minister did not refer to this as a ceasefire. Here is an interpreted clip of his news conference yesterday. This is Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, as heard on TRT World, which is a Turkish state-run news network.
Within 120 hours, YPG, PKK will leave the zone. As we pause the peace spring operation, this is not a stopping of the operation, it's a pause. This is not a ceasefire, because a ceasefire takes place between two legitimate parties. The goal of the operation was the removal of terrorists from the safe zone, and this is why we are pausing the operation.
That was Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, as heard on TRT World through an interpreter. So, Indira, we've got this contradiction. The U.S. called it a ceasefire. The Turkish government says you can't have a ceasefire with an illegitimate party. There's damage on the ground. We're not entirely clear, I think, of the extent of the damage so far. So where are we?
Well, I just want to sort of widen the lens and step back for a moment, because since this all only began last Saturday night, I think there are a lot of listeners who might not be up to speed on everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting to sort of look at the question. President Trump said late Saturday night that he was going to be withdrawing U.S. troops from northern Syria, where we have kept this uneasy peace, and taking troops out of where they had been working with our Syrian Kurd allies, who really have been our main allies in the fight against ISIS and other terrorist groups. Of course, the problem is that Turkey sees the Syrian Kurds as strong allies of the PKK, the Turkish Kurds, who both Turkey and the United States consider a terrorist organization. So there's always been this tension between Turkey and the United States over our support for the Syrian Kurds on the other side of the Turkish border. And essentially what seems to have happened is, the Pentagon secretary has said, well, in fact, there was no way that we were going to be able to prevent this. Turkey had made clear to us that they were going to go in across their border into Syria, and they were going to take out the Syrian Kurds and all of that. So there was nothing we could do. And there's no way that with American forces numbering only 1,000 that we could fight against an ally. By the way, also, Turkey, let's remind people, is a NATO ally of the United States, and we have forces based there and everything, so it would make no sense to go to war against Turkey, so we just pulled out. But what Donald Trump seems to have done, according to his critics, is essentially given the green light to Turkey to go ahead, rage across the border, kill all the Kurds you want, and then it also gives a green light to the Syrian government, to Damascus, and now our old allies, the Syrian Kurds, have been forced to, you know, take the embrace of the Syrian government, who were their enemies, and come to this ceasefire, pause, whatever you want to call it. But it's had so many consequences in terms of ISIS and other terrorists being let out of jails where they were being kept by these Syrian Kurds. It's led to the deaths of, you know, we think, certainly dozens of our Syrian Kurdish allies, and the displacement of 130,000 people. And so many American military people are speaking out, even though they're not supposed to speak out, under the rules of the uniform code. They're not supposed to say anything, but they've been saying this is shameful. We're abandoning our allies. These are people we worked with, you know, shoulder to shoulder. So, I mean, what I find the most interesting result of all of this is that the polling is showing that among Americans who follow foreign policy, that 54%, and this includes Republicans, think that the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Syria has damaged our standing as an ally and someone who, you know, forces who work with us can depend on.
Got some perspectives from some of our listeners about our standing with our allies and just the way we've been handling this whole situation. Anne emailed, "It is folly to drive away Turkey, a NATO ally and one of our closest Muslim partners, into the arms of Russia, as the latest U.S. sanctions seem poised to do. I would argue that years of Western empowerment of Kurds in Iraq and Syria has mostly strengthened Iran and driven Turkey away from democratic reforms to include Turkey's Kurds." Daniel emailed, "It's true that fighting in the Middle East has gone on for centuries. What this president fails to also admit is for the last 70 years or so, much of that fighting has been due to Western powers interfering in Middle Eastern affairs." Courtney, I'm still struggling to figure out what it is that President Trump thought was going to happen, what the advantage was, if there was anything besides I made a political promise to bring the troops home and I'm bringing the troops home, particularly because there really weren't that many troops in this region. There were like 50 special forces soldiers who were helping the YPG learn how to do special operations and basically providing them advice and guidance. There weren't that many. So I'm fuzzy on what the president thought we were going to get out of
it. So, yeah, it was even less than that. It was what the military calls two ODA teams, their operational detachment teams. So they basically they're 12 to 14 men that are on these forward bases with very little around them. They're self-sustaining. But it wasn't, those were the immediate teams that were pulled back from the border. But then there's been much larger repercussions. There are a number of outposts up, you know, that have been taken back. I've struggled with this, I'll be honest with you, since this all happened. Because look at it from, if you're the military, the Pentagon leadership has said that they recommended that the U.S. pull back from the border because they had no choice, that Erdogan called the president and said, we are coming in no matter what you do. So look at it from their perspective of, if they had left the troops there, Americans there, and the fighting had begun and they were not allowed to fight back against a NATO ally, they would be sitting ducks. And if someone was injured or killed, it would be on the head of them to make that decision. But you could make the argument that maybe President Trump could have used more American leverage to force Erdogan not to send his troops in, including leveraging the nukes at Incirlik or some other diplomacy. And it's impossible for us to know which way it would have gone.
Much more to discuss as we continue the Friday News Roundup with Courtney Kuby, Peter Berg, and Indira Lakshmanan. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. I know we're all consumed with the troubles of the world, but before we continue, we should salute two astronauts, Christina Cook and Jessica Meir. At 7:38 Eastern Time this morning, they stepped outside the International Space Station to replace a faulty battery charger. It was the first all-female spacewalk. The all-clear was given by NASA's spacewalk coordinator Stephanie Wilson with the words, "Christina, you may egress the airlock." It's the Friday News Roundup with Indira Lakshmanan of the Pulitzer Center, NBC's Courtney Kuby, and Peter Bergen of CNN and New America, also the author of The United States of Jihad. Plenty to talk about in the troubles of the world, our earthly problems and predicaments. So comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. This week we learned that some of America's most senior foreign policy officials had raised an alarm about the Trump administration's potential illegal activity in Ukraine way before President Trump had that call with his counterpart in Kiev, President Zelensky. We know this from new testimony that was provided to the impeachment inquiry. The most newsworthy pushback came from White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney just yesterday. Here he is, and he made it very plain that U.S. foreign policy is often about quid pro quos.
We do that all the time with foreign policy. We were holding up money at the same time for, what was it, the Northern Triangle countries. By the way, and this speaks to an important point, because I heard this yesterday. If you read the news reports and you believe them, what did McKinney say yesterday? Well, McKinney said yesterday that he was really upset with the political influence in foreign policy. And I have news for everybody. Get over it.
That was White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney speaking yesterday during a press conference. By the way, the man he referred to as McKinney is actually named McKinley, Michael McKinley, one of the people who testified this week. Peter, I'm not sure where to go with this, except that Mick Mulvaney admitted to something extremely bad. When Congress apportions money, the administration has to spend that money. That's the law, unless there is some kind of gigantic purpose for them to go back to Congress and say, no, we can't spend this money. And to say that there was a quid pro quo for a matter of national security, defense of one of our allies in Eastern Europe, that sounds just bad all the way around. But am I missing something?
I don't think so. And, you know, there's a famous definition of what a gaffe is in Washington, which is telling the truth in public. And that's what he did, which is, yes, of course, there was a quid pro quo. Now you try to walk that back with a written statement. But what's interesting to me about all this is there is a deep state. It's not a deep state of a conspiracist trying to bring down the Trump administration. It's a bunch of professional civil servants who basically don't like doing things that are illegal or maybe illegal or being involved in some way in things that they think are not kosher. And, you know, Michael McKinley, who we just mentioned, I mean, he's a career foreign service, you know, very senior ambassador to variously, you know, Afghanistan and other countries, who was one of the top advisors to Mike Pompeo. And he's resigned because he just, you know, he doesn't like what's going on. And similarly, Fiona Hill, even though she was a political appointee who's also testified, you know, she's a longtime CIA analyst and working for multiple different administrations. And again, you know, what she saw going on with basically our foreign policy in Ukraine outsourced to Rudy Giuliani as opposed to professional diplomats made her feel very uncomfortable. And by the way, if you had a parking ticket, would you employ Rudy Giuliani as your lawyer? I mean, he's so erratic and bombastic and seemingly like off the rails. And that's the guy that we deputized our foreign policy to. So the whole thing is odd at a minimum.
Since we mentioned Mick Mulvaney's statement, it reads in part, quote, "Once again, the media has decided to misconstrue my comments to advance a biased and political witch hunt." Let me finish. Let me try that again. Quote, "Once again, the media has decided to misconstrue my comments to advance a biased and political witch hunt against President Trump. Let me be clear. There was absolutely no quid pro quo between Ukrainian military aid and any investigation into the 2016 election. The president never told me to withhold any money until the Ukrainians did anything related to the server," unquote. That is part of the statement from Mick Mulvaney after he said the exact opposite in that news conference. Indira, Mick Mulvaney's role in this is interesting, too, because he is one of the players that's also kind of emerged as part of this Ukraine influence campaign, at least as it's been alleged. So I think it's understandable why he would want to try to cover his tracks.
Right. I mean, it is, as you say, completely bizarre that his statement a few hours later, after clearly every lawyer in the administration had jumped on him in the White House and said, "What the heck do you think you're talking about?" And then he had to say the exact opposite of what he had said on the record to an entire room, the White House press briefing room.
Who had been pressing him for a while.
But honestly, it wasn't that hard to get him to admit what he admitted. I mean, he basically said, first of all, to your earlier point, he said administrations do this all the time. I want to clarify what he's saying there, though, because while it is true that the United States exerts foreign policy pressure on our allies and our adversaries all the time and always holds up carrots and sticks, that's part of what we do, that's part of the toolbox that diplomats talk about, it's not the same as seeking individual political gain for the person sitting in the White House. That's totally different from trying to get national security gain for the United States overall. Likewise, as Peter said, this is money that had already been appropriated by Congress. I mean, even so, if we think an ally or an adversary is doing, well, we wouldn't be giving money to an adversary, but if we think an ally is doing something wrong, even after money is appropriated, then there would be conversations about that. But this is completely different because it's about personal political gain. Now, what was funny was that Mick Mulvaney was trying to split hairs about whether it was about investigating the 2016 campaign or investigating the 2020 campaign. And, you know, none of those really hold up. I do think, you know, you point out that this triumvirate of people who were involved in this. I mean, Mick Mulvaney was key. Rudy Giuliani was key. Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU, was key. And the fact that he came, I mean, not necessarily willingly under subpoena, he came to testify, but he did distance himself from the president. He did say, well, you know, I was disappointed to be ordered by the president to work with Giuliani on Ukraine policy. And let's point out, Rudy Giuliani has never been Senate confirmed. He has no legitimacy to deal with foreign policy of the United States as the president's personal lawyer. So clearly, Sondland was putting distance between himself and the president, which shows some CYA behavior. And one last thing, you mentioned Fiona Hill, who was a senior Russia advisor to the president. And it was very interesting because she said in her testimony that John Bolton, the former national security advisor, had actually said that Giuliani was a hand grenade in the middle of U.S. foreign policy. So clearly people were worried about this.
Courtney, Gordon Sondland, who is the U.S. ambassador to the EU, was one of the people who testified this week. Here he is speaking to Ukraine TV, talking about who was running U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine.
We have what are called the three amigos, and the three amigos are Secretary Perry, again, Ambassador Volker, and myself. And we've been tasked with sort of overseeing the Ukraine-U.S. relationship between our contacts at the highest levels of the U.S. government and now the highest levels of the Ukrainian government.
So Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU, Kurt Volker, who was then an envoy to Ukraine for its peace negotiations, and Rick Perry, who stepped down or announced he'd be stepping down as energy secretary this week. What's the impact of Gordon Sondland and this three amigos comment?
So it's a strange grouping. You know, Gordon Sondland, nobody talks about this, but he's the ambassador to the EU. Well, Ukraine's not in the EU. So, you know, he's grabbing outside of his portfolio and taking over. There, one of the things Fiona Hill testified this week was that there was this altercation back in July when he was talking to some Ukrainian officials who were in D.C. and how he said, well, President Trump has told me that I'm the one who's dealing with the Ukraine issue. And that was when she, you know, and Ambassador Bolton said this needs to go to the White House lawyers to figure it out. The one thing that I was really struck by was, in addition to what Indira was saying about Gordon Sondland trying to distance himself from the president, he definitely was trying to minimize his role in this entire Ukraine matter, including saying that he was really disappointed that the three amigos had to go through Rudy Giuliani to talk about Ukraine policy and that he had to sort of vet things that they were doing, but that they were so interested in pursuing this, you know, stronger relationship between the U.S. and Ukraine that they were willing to do what they needed to do, you know, for the good of the country and the good of this alliance, potential alliance. But the notion that he didn't know what Giuliani's ultimate goals were when Rudy Giuliani was on television talking about it. You know, he openly talked last spring about how he had this planned trip to Ukraine, to Kiev, where he was going to advance the president's goals of finding out what happened in the 2016 election and finding Hillary Clinton's server, a long debunked, you know, conspiracy theory that this server exists in Ukraine. So if Gordon Sondland didn't know ultimately what Rudy Giuliani, where his motivations were in this matter, all he needed to do was Google it.
Jim emailed, the president's decisions regarding Turkey, Syria, and the Kurds are horrific on so many levels. I would also like to point out that our president is a master of distraction. With the heat of impeachment being turned up, suddenly he causes this scene in the Middle East. Our focus shifts from the impeachment to the Middle East, and the heat gets lowered. Peter, I wonder about that. I mean, I think all of these things are starting to feel of a piece with one another. The nature of the policy with Turkey and Syria, the conversation with President Zelensky in Ukraine, the role of Rudy Giuliani as this kind of de facto foreign policy diplomat, whatever it is, and then the disagreement of Republicans with the president over things that are material to our military standing around the world, which is a gigantic point of pride and honor for the American people. So I hear where Jim's coming from, but I don't know. This isn't the Mueller report. Like, this isn't complex. So I'm wondering, what do you think of Jim's comment? I think people are walking and chewing gum right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. It's hard to assess if this is intentional to kind of distract from the impeachment. I just have no idea. But I will say everything seems entirely improvised. And if you look at the people that are surrounding President Trump right now, you know, Mark Esper is no Jim Mattis, who is the new Secretary of Defense. Perfectly competent guy, but he's not going to stand up. The new National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, you know, famously attended the trial of ASAP Rocky in Sweden when he was the hostage negotiator for the U.S. government. Kind of a waste of time in most people's view. So, but something that basically President Trump wanted him to do. So I think the number of people around President Trump who can basically say no, and Courtney just mentioned John Bolton was very unhappy about how this Ukraine thing was going, and now, of course, he's gone, has gone down. So I don't think there's any like master plan here. I think Trump is just gets up every morning and kind of riffs, and, you know, I mean, he says one thing one day that is very strongly held, and then the next day completely changes his mind. I mean, he green-lighted this Turkish invasion, right? And then the next day he's saying, we're going to destroy the Turkish economy if you go through with this. Well, what is it? And I think this thing produces a lot of confusion, not only amongst our allies, but also our enemies. And our enemies, I think, have begun to discount him. And just like, look at what Erdogan has just done exactly what he wanted to do.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Ray emailed, if having the G7 summit at a Trump resort isn't a violation of the emoluments clause, what is? Well, the G7 summit next June will, at least currently as it's planned, be held at one of President Trump's golf resorts in Florida, the Trump National in Doral, which is just west of Miami. It's about a 10-minute drive west of the airport. White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, who seems to be the special guest star in this week's clips, denied that the president would profit from the event at Doral. But responding to questions from reporters, it was clear that this was the president's idea.
We were back in the dining room, and I'm going over it with a couple of our Vance team. We had the list, and he goes, "What about Doral?" And I was like, "That's not the craziest idea. It makes perfect sense. We're all familiar with it, so it's not like he said, "Oh, buddy, this is what Doral is. I have to explain it." He said, "No, what about Doral?" I'm like, you know what? That's not the craziest idea we ever heard. We sat down and went, go look at it.
Now, NPR and others have been reporting that the resort in Doral has been losing money. Public records obtained by the Washington Post show an 18% decline in revenue at Doral from 2015 to 2017. That's about $17 million. Operating income fell 70% in that time. The Miami Herald has reported that the county lowered the property value of the resort for property tax purposes because it's been losing so much money. Indira, all of that points to the idea that the president would do this to, you know, enrich his, to line his pockets, to raise the value of Doral, et cetera. As a native South Floridian, I know a little bit about the region. I guess it could work for the G7, but that almost doesn't seem to be the point. It's almost like the personal enrichment is the point, but it's also not the point at the same time.
Oh, it's the point.
It's the point? Okay.
You know,
I was hoping you'd tell me it was another point.
If the president were to say, I have this fabulous resort in Doral and I'd be happy to donate it for the use by the G7 at no cost, fine. Then he's making a donation to the U.S. Treasury coffers by lending his resort out in kind. But if he's expecting to be paid, which he has expected to be paid, and let's not forget the millions and millions of dollars that American taxpayers have paid for officials staying at his various resorts because he's, you know, so frequently golfing and staying in his own resorts. He's even tried to style his Mar-a-Lago resort as the sort of Southern Camp David, the Southern White House. So, you know, the more that we are spending taxpayer dollars on guarding him whenever he goes and putting up officials. Don't you remember? It was just a few weeks ago now when we were all talking about Mike Pence on a trip to the UK and the, you know, the British Isles and how he was commuting hours to get to, I think it was Trump's golf resort in Turnberry in Scotland, when he could have stayed somewhere very nearby to where he was, but he was doing that and paying for it. And this money is going into the coffers of Trump's resorts. So that is definitely self-dealing. I don't think there's any other way of looking at it. But somehow, despite the fact that from day one, people have been saying the president shouldn't be taking money. Think about the Trump hotel right here in Washington, where so many foreign governments put their people, and that money is going into the Trump organization's coffers.
Before we pause, Courtney, what about just security provisions for the G7? I mean, I understand the problems with Mar-a-Lago. It's on a barrier island. It's in Palm Beach. It's hard to get in and out. God forbid something should happen. Mm-hmm. Doral is, it's inland. It's near the airport, so there's probably a Homeland Security contingent there. It ain't Miami Beach. Mm-hmm. But is that also a factor in terms of planning where all these world leaders are going to be?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one of the big factors they look at is a facility large enough and can they provide the security necessary for something like this? Doral is far from it. I'm sure it's not even the only location in Florida that could potentially be looked at for this kind of thing. I mean,
far from it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mick Mulvaney said they looked at about a dozen, 10 or 12 different locations and that this one just rose to the top and it made the most sense. So the thing that really struck me was I just don't fundamentally understand his argument that President Trump will not profit from this. It just fundamentally doesn't make sense to me. If his resort makes money off of this, it will be from foreign leaders, by the way. So how will that not benefit President Trump? But just how tone deaf it is. You know, it's not like this is the only location that they could have chosen. It's not like, oh, let's send all these world leaders, many of them from places that are not particularly warm climates, to Miami in June, where it's going to be hot. I mean, there's, you know, there were other locations. It was just a tone deaf decision. And it also just fights this whole idea of cronyism and whatnot that the Trump administration is criticizing others for.
We'll continue in just a moment with Courtney Cubey, Peter Bergen, and Indira Lakshmanan. We note our northern neighbors are about to go to the polls. Canada votes on Monday, 4 years after Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party swept to power. We'll keep an eye on that in the weeks to come. We'll get back to the news of this week in a minute. Stay close. Back now to the roundup with NBC's Courtney Kuby, Peter Bergen of CNN and New America, and Indira Lakshmanan of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Still time to get in a few more of your questions and thoughts, 1A@WAMU.org. We seem to be doing pretty well on time, so let me back up to Turkey. Jim emailed, can you speak to the theory raised by Senator Romney that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan might have given President Trump an ultimatum and that Trump caved? Courtney?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the many theories that only the people on the phone call really know that. And, you know, conversations that you have, unless they put out a transcript, we're never really going to know it.
One listener asked whether a transcript was going to be published.
I mean, given this administration, I doubt it, no matter how hard we push for it. But without seeing a transcript, we're never really going to know exactly how hard. The military officials who I've spoken with insist that President Trump pushed very hard. But then when I asked about any specific ultimatums, no one can tell me any that he actually gave. The thing to keep in mind is that, yes, President Erdogan did give the U.S. a heads up this was happening, but it also is not a surprise. I know people haven't necessarily been paying attention to this as much as we might, but Turkey has been building up its military along the border for months now. President Erdogan has increased his rhetoric, very much so even in the last couple of weeks. And from a military perspective, you could see along the border that they were doing things that indicated that an invasion was likely and coming, getting their logistics ready, things like getting their bridging equipment together, moving personnel and artillery and whatnot down there. It was clear that President Erdogan was planning to move in. The question is, could President Trump on that phone call have done something that would have forced him that didn't include potentially putting the U.S. military in the crossfire?
Marcia tweeted, were there any talks of the U.S. taking in Kurdish refugees, especially those who had worked with the U.S. military as part of the negotiation? Peter, I wonder if there were talks, but in terms of refugees, I think one of the things that's been a narrative with Turkey in the past that's given it some leverage with the EU is that there are refugee paths that run through Turkey because there's a border with Bulgaria and Greece in the northwest of Turkey.
Yeah, I think there are 3.6 million Syrian refugees in Turkey. And by the way, guess how many the United States have taken? This is the largest refugee outflow, one of the largest since World War II. I think last year we took 60.
Yeah, not 60,000.
660.
So I imagine.
So it was. This was not part of a discussion.
Right.
We're taking effectively zero.
We got some questions, Indira, about the nature of the military relationship or just the other connections between the U.S. and Turkey, including from Peter, who asked if the U.S. still stationed nuclear warheads in Turkey. How much are we entangled with Turkey in that way?
I mean, very much so. They're a key NATO ally, and we're part of NATO. And we've heard President Trump talking for years now, even before he was president, about how he has problems with NATO. He thinks that they owe us money, that they all need to be stepping up to the plate. But our relationship with Turkey has not faltered from a military point of view. I mean, look, if we don't get a readout of this call, no one's going to give us a transcript. If we don't even get a readout of this call, I think it's pretty fair to say all the reporting has shown that President Erdogan said in the call, I am going to do this. So in that way, as Peter and Courtney have said, he was giving Donald Trump a heads up. Donald Trump doesn't want American forces killed. So he made a decision. Let's move out of there. The difference was that he then follows it up after there's so much anger and confusion about how could you abandon our allies. He follows it up with this letter, which the White House admitted to, released, stood by, in which Donald Trump basically says to Erdogan, don't be a fool. Mm-hmm. I will call you later. And essentially says, you know, how can you do this? The letter was astonishing. And for any listeners who haven't read it,
and he noted in the letter that he included a correspondence from General Mazlum Abdi, who's the head of the Syrian mm-hmm. Defense Forces, our allies in the fight against ISIS, and saying they're ready to make concessions. Essentially, they're ready to make concessions if you'll make a deal.
But it's a bit after the fact. If he wanted to say that, he should have said that before rather than green lighting this whole situation. And let's not forget the extent to which Donald Trump has really downplayed, has tried to act as if the American people shouldn't care about what's going on. He's referred to the Middle East as they have a lot of sand over there. They can fight in the sand. He referred to it last night. It was at a campaign rally in Texas as saying, you know, they're going to have to fight it out as if they're kids on a schoolyard, you know, completely forgetting that the United States got involved in this. The United States was using the Syrian Kurds to defend against ISIS. And now, as I said, all those ISIS prisoners have been let free out of those jails. So there are so many consequences. I can understand the president wanting to uphold his promise to keep U.S. troops out or take them out of the Middle East, but he doesn't seem to have thought through the consequences.
Before we move on and talk about China and Hong Kong, we should say a quick word about the U.K. and Boris Johnson, who may have pulled a Brexit rabbit out of the hat. This week, there was a last-minute compromise deal with the Prime Minister's exhausted European counterparts. That raises the prospect that Britain could actually leave the EU by the end of this month. But now comes the hard part. Prime Minister Johnson has to get approval for his draft deal in Parliament, and that begins with an extraordinary, rare Saturday meeting of the House of Commons. Indira, this is the point at which other Prime Minister, Theresa May, of course, got tripped up before. So just because there is a deal that the EU says go vote on doesn't mean that the deal is done.
Yeah, two quick thoughts on this. First of all, the deal is not that different from the deal that Theresa May had. And in fact, it is going to bother his Northern Irish allies from the DUP. This is the Unionist Party. It's going to bother them even more because it's actually keeping Northern Ireland in the customs union. So now it's sort of going beyond the backstop, which people may have heard about. I mean, I think ironically, if this deal gets passed, he may actually be the British Prime Minister who serves to unify Ireland in a way by, you know, making sure that Northern and the Republic of Ireland are all within the same customs union. So it's going to be interesting to see whether he gets this deal through or not. But he can call it what he wants. He can call it a breakthrough. But anybody who reads it can see it's not that much different from what there was before.
Speaking of deals, let's shift gears to China and talk about the prospect of a trade deal between China and the U.S. That remains uncertain after the two countries reached a tentative agreement last week. CNBC's Carl Quintanilla spoke with top White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow yesterday. Mr. Kudlow was optimistic about finishing the deal.
People shouldn't be so pessimistic about the China talks and that some good things could happen. And I think this whole phase one is a good thing that's happening. And for the skeptics out there, I appreciate that and I respect that. But I'm telling you, there's a lot of momentum and there's agreement on both sides.
That's White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow speaking yesterday on CNBC. Peter, we've heard Larry Kudlow speak about optimism before. Don't be so pessimistic. Be willing to be optimistic in the American economic future. But do we know anything about this tentative deal, where the U.S. and China stand? Is Mr. Kudlow's optimism well-placed?
My impression about the deal where it stands right now is they've kind of deferred the bigger issues. You know, I think China has agreed to buy something like, I think, $40 to $50 billion more of Chinese agricultural products. But it doesn't leave aside. I mean, we still and Trump is not going to impose. I think they were going to go from 25% to 30% tariffs on, you know, a couple of hundred billions dollars plus of Chinese products. And he's not going to do that. But this is it's actually kind of a somewhat incremental step. This is not like some grand bargain. And at the end of the day, if I'm Xi and the Communist Party in China, I'm aware there's an American election, which Trump could lose. I mean, he could win as well. And, you know, I'm not going to necessarily do a deal that is hugely to my disadvantage with somebody that may lose the election. So I think they're just going to wait and see what happens in the election, just like the Iranians or just like other American, you know, basically rivals.
Meanwhile, while this is going on between the U.S. and Beijing, the leader of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, was forced to suspend her annual speech before Parliament. That's because pro-democracy lawmakers interrupted. They were rallying and climbing on the tables. They were chanting five demands, not one less, in reference to their list of demands for the Hong Kong government. Indira, this all kind of sparked with this extradition bill that would allow, like, people accused of major crimes to be extradited back to Beijing. These five demands have been on the table for quite some time. You spent a good amount of time in Hong Kong. What does this look like to you?
Yeah, okay. I spent 7 years based in Hong Kong as a reporter for the Boston Globe, and including the Hong Kong handover in 1997 when China took back control of Hong Kong, which had been a British colony. And this is exactly what people were worried about in 1997, when people said, you know, Beijing is promising one country, two systems, but are they really going to let this, you know, incredible international entrepot you know, incredible economic success story? Are they going to allow these people to self-govern? And we've proven now, 22 years later, they're not allowing them to self-govern. There are no direct elections in Hong Kong. It's not just the extradition bill, which, by the way, would have allowed Hong Kongers, many of whom don't ever go to China, to be extradited to mainland China. Listeners may have heard about the booksellers who had been selling controversial, i.e., democratic books, and how they were just disappeared across the border to China. There's a lot of upset about this in China. I can't overstate this. I mean, there were periods when, you know, one in four people in Hong Kong were literally marching in the streets over this. And it's not just, everyone remembers Joe Wilson yelling at President Obama during the State of the Union, "You lie!" Imagine that magnified with people, as you say, climbing on the tables. She was not able to finish her equivalent of the State of the Union. I personally think that these protests could go on for years. And I think they could have a very, very bad outcome if Beijing finally gets sick of it and decides that they're going to roll in with some sort of Tiananmen-style crackdown. I dearly pray that does not happen.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Another interesting story related to China had to do with NBA star LeBron James. He stepped into this ongoing NBA-China debate this week. On Monday, he criticized Daryl Morey, who's the manager for the Houston Rockets. Morey had been tweeting in support of Hong Kong protesters. Here is part of what King James had to say.
I just think that, you know, when you're misinformed or you're not educated about something, and I'm just talking about, you know, the tweet itself, you know, you never know the ramifications that can happen. You know, we all seen what that did. Not only did for our league, but for all of us in America, for people in China as well. And sometimes you have to think through things that you say that may cause harm, not only for yourself, but for the majority of people.
Now, Courtney, I find this story fascinating because on the face of it, it just looks like, you know, some NBA executive making some public statement, oh, yes, we should support such and such people. China doesn't like it. And then he backs down and says, oh, I'm really sorry. And then LeBron James says, yeah, you should have thought about it more carefully. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more under the surface of this,
yeah.
Not just economically, but in just, I think, the whole geopolitical relationship between the U.S. and China. This is one of those microcosms of it that, at least to me, has a way bigger meaning.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the economic piece of it, right? So LeBron James has a partnership with Nike. He's had it for like 15 or 16 years. In that time, he's gone to China just about every day. I saw some reports that it makes him about $30 million a year, just that partnership. So he has a strong economic tie. I actually read his comments about this to be nothing to do necessarily with what's happening between China and Hong Kong right now, but more about the tweet having economic repercussions, right? It's, you know, it has an implication if China doesn't allow the NBA to travel there, if they cut ties with NBA stars, you know, and he is certainly not the only one who's profiting from apparel and shoe companies in China. If they cut it risks potentially millions of dollars for players and for the NBA, and it hurts the league and everything. The problem was he came off looking like he was an apologist for an authoritarian regime who does not believe in freedom of speech and has a terrible human rights record. And that was what a lot of people saw here. The reality is, I think if you peel back the onion a little bit, at the end of the day, he's a basketball player. He's not out there talking about human rights. And he's more interested, it seems to me, from my very little knowledge of anything to do with the NBA. I fully, completely admit. I had to look up what team he plays for. I admit it. But, you know, it seems to me as this was really more about his financial motivations than actual freedom of speech.
One last story before we go. Maybe some of you have made that 5.5-hour flight from California to New York. It's really, really long. If you think that flight is too long, consider a new experimental flight from Qantas Airways. This weekend, it will test the first ever 20-hour flight. About 50 scientists and researchers will take off from New York on a Boeing Dreamliner today. They will arrive in Sydney, Australia, Sunday morning. They'll monitor the physical and mental impact a 20-hour non-stop flight has on passengers and pilots. Scientists have found that jet lag is more than a discomfort, like waking up at 3 in the morning. Research shows that crossing more than 2 time zones on a flight disrupts our internal clocks and can have major physical impacts, including cardiovascular challenges and weight gain in regular travelers. This flight will cross 9 time zones. We appreciate spending this hour with our frequent flyers, Indira Lakshmanan of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Thanks, Indira.
Thank you.
NBC National Security and Military Reporter Courtney Kuby. Thanks, Courtney.
Thank you.
And Peter Bergen of CNN New America and the author of The United States of Jihad. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Joshua.
Oh, by the way, Peter, a listener sent you a limerick in response to that comment about D.C. and the gaffe being telling the truth in public. Alan emailed, "Now Mulvaney denies. What a laugh. In D.C., the truth is a gaffe. Now Mulvaney denies. What a laugh. No quid pro quo. He just told you so. Having fits is the White House staff." 1A senior producers are Paige Osborne and Danielle Knight. Our executive producer is Rupert Allman. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have a perfectly lyrical weekend. This is 1A.